This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we're wondering if you're just as sick and tired of hearing depressing news as we are. If so, we give you a 100% virus-free program today as we focus on happy science in three short reprised interviews with the experts. First, we learn about the surprising powers of your heart to bring you peace, love, truth, and joy. Then we talk with a neuroscientist about how music can have almost magical healing effects on the brain. And we finish with a geologist who finds clues to the past by looking at stone buildings in Seattle and Port Townsend. And now we go inside the Compass. When you have a broken heart, is it all in your mind? If so, why don't they call it a broken mind? Dan McManus has a few thoughts on that. The Port Townsend resident teaches a course called Starting with the Heart, Cultivating Peace, Love, Truth, and Joy. We talked with McManus about his somewhat controversial concept. So many of us understand the feeling of a broken heart or a heart full of love. But I believe medical science generally holds that the heart is just a pump muscle and that the brain is the actual seat of all emotion. But I have a feeling you would disagree, yes?
Yes, and I think current neurocardiology would disagree. What they found is that the heart, Rudolf Steiner, who was formed Waldorf schools, said that the biggest scientific breakthrough of the 20th century would be to discover that the heart was more than a pump.
That concept, that the heart is much more than just a pump, is at the center of Daniel's personal philosophy. McManus holds a master's degree in education and is a certified senior teacher through the Institute for Applied Meditation. He also calls himself a heart ecologist and is co-founder of Heart Mentors. We ask Daniel what those terms actually mean.
A heart ecologist is a person who understands that the environment has an effect on our heart. I think all of us could agree to that. Mm-hmm. But the second piece of it is a double reflection, that our heart can have an effect on our environment. So that when we're feeling, for example, very much in our heart and very much working from our heart, we can create, a beautiful environment around us mm-hmm. that then later we can come into when we're feeling down, and that environment can pick us up.
Interesting.
Because our heart has had an effect on that. One of the goals of heart ecology is to realize that we're constantly having this dialogue back and forth, this interaction between ourselves and the world. We know that the heart's electromagnetic field pulsates outside the body 10 to 20 feet. And it's constantly broadcasting our emotional state to ourselves and to our environment and to others.
Fascinating.
And so when we can shift that emotional state to states of compassion, love, joy, peace, then we're broadcasting that into our environment. And we know how that feels when we walk into a room sometimes and meet somebody who we're immediately drawn to, or we immediately relax and go into a peaceful state. We're actually probably picking up the information that's coming from their electromagnetic field of their heart. So that's part of what heart ecology looks at. Heart mentors is my business term, and what it comes from is the idea that we are all heart mentors, that we're all constantly mentoring other people's hearts in the best way we can through friendships, through affection, through a pat on the back, through consoling them in some ways, being there for them, listening deeply from our heart, mm-hmm. really hearing what they're saying on a deep level and just being present, so that kind of process then to teach people how to be in their hearts, to make their hearts available to others, and to start off by first connecting to the other person's heart rather than with necessarily their problems. So when I worked with social workers and therapists, and person would come in with all kinds of issues and problems, homeless and kids and how to get the fuel to the car and how to find a job, where do we start? And the answer that we've come up with and worked with these people is we start with the heart. Mm-hmm. We start with finding your own heart and coming into your own heart and connect to their heart in some way. Because at that point, you begin to actually have this empathy that's tangible. And from there, their own wisdom, their own heart's wisdom can start to come online. And often they can solve their own problems or come up with ideas themselves. So the heart mentoring is a constant flow back and forth between two people's hearts.
So we're all heart mentors, even without realizing it.
We are all heart mentors, and we're just trying to find some very simple tools like heart rhythm meditation that make it more conscious and more repeatable.
How does one move from a mind-centered self to a heart-centered self, and why is that a good thing?
Well, we know the heart and mind actually are connected, obviously, and they're working together. The traditional definition is that the mind is the surface of the heart, and the heart is the depth of the mind. So we know that mind speaks to mind, but heart speaks to heart. And the mind consciousness tends to rely a lot on rationality and control, and I'm going to set these, and that's wonderful. We have that. We need that piece of ourselves. But the heart works much more synchronistically, intuitively, and we get hunches, and we get feelings that are very strong, and if those are allowed to then come up towards the mind, then the mind can take this wonderful, powerful, passionate, this goal I might have for myself or this passion I have in my life, and then the mind can work with how to make it happen. But that information is coming up from a deeper level.
I think you probably have an opinion on this. Why do you think cardiac disease is the number one cause of death in the United States?
Yeah, isn't that a huge cultural problem? Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is because one of the things in this, we look at how our system runs, I think we are adrenaline junkies. Roz Carroll, a psychotherapist out of England, says that we're a culture that's chronically sympathetically aroused. The sympathetic is the gas part of our system. The parasympathetic is the brake and slow down, repose. Mm-hmm. So we're chronically sympathetically aroused. It's very hard on our hearts. And the adrenal cortisol that flows through our system is also very detrimental to long-term heart. In other words, we can live in sort of a amped up, always ready, fight or flight, take it on for a short period of time. But chronically, I mean, over time, that becomes very, very hard on our, literally physically hard on our hearts. Mm-hmm. And our hearts actually fatigue. And of course, the brain's solution to that problem is to go out and get another heart and transplant it in. So once it's burned out its resource and burned out its support system, it goes and plugs another support system in there.
Yeah.
That's the brain solution. I think a more compassionate solution is to start to breathe into our hearts, connect with our hearts, put our hearts in rhythm, and let the heart then heal and reassert itself as sort of the real center, the real emotional regulator of our system is our heart. Mm-hmm. Not the brain.
And that is that heart-centered self that you're talking about. That's the solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the solution.
What steps can we take? And I'm sure you have lots of thoughts on this too. What steps can we take? Can I take? Can one who's listening to this radio show take to avoid being one of the approximately 1 million people in the U.S. who die every year from heart disease?
Yeah.
What's the secret? How do we solve this?
I think the secret is that we literally start by tuning into our hearts more, whether that's simply putting a hand on our heart and taking some time just to feel our heart, whether it's a time to notice our heartbeats, whether it's time to go out and walk in nature and get revitalized by nature. Mm-hmm. and having that come in. Taking time, I always tell people, when you have a wonderful moment happen, somebody has a baby, your granddaughter is in front of you, somebody's standing in front of you, take time to breathe that in and savor it. Mm-hmm. Take time to truly be present for that moment and really let that come into your heart. Really let that come in and affect your heart and feel the feeling. Because what Damasio says, who's a neurologist, is the brain speed is about 1/400,000th of a second. We process instantly through our brain. Mm-hmm. But the body speed, which won't ever speed up, which is where our heart is, takes about 1 to 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. In order to process information. So if we take that time to take that breath, a hand on our heart, soften our belly, and really take time to be with those positive situations, I think we begin to feed, gather, and store these treasures in our heart for a time down the road when we may really need them.
It may sound a bit like New Age pseudoscience, but McManus insists the research is there to back him up.
The heart actually has its own independent intelligence. It's an independent sensory organ, separate, so it's not completely influenced by the brain. We know the heart has memory, has neural cells in it, 40,000 neural cells with synapses and all that, just like the brain has. It's also been reclassified recently as a part of the endocrine system, so it's a hormonal organ, so it's constantly releasing hormones to adjust our emotional state and to our emotional states and influencing our emotional states. But the heart can actually, when it goes into coherent, balanced states, actually sends a signal to the brain that shifts our perception and our understanding of what we see. It's interesting that Candace Pert's work, The Molecules of Emotion, when she began looking for work that came up with the idea that the body is the subconscious mind. The body actually stores and is, and we think with our whole body. All those neuropeptides we think of in the brain are actually body-wide. They're everywhere. And what's interesting is she says that 200 to 300 neuropeptides, informational substances, are all, the receptor sites are all on the surface of our heart. So our heart has something to do with processing emotion.
So, obviously, you've got to have heart.
You gotta have heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course. But keep that old horse before the cart. First, you gotta have heart. How
is it that people who have strokes or Alzheimer's disease can sing even when they can no longer speak? What's that magical connection between music and the brain? KPTZ posed those questions to one of the nation's leading researchers in this area. Mark Jude Tramo came to Port Townsend for a presentation called Music and the Brain, staged by the local Songwriting Works organization. Dr. Tramo is a neurology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, a faculty fellow at the Harvard Mind, Brain, and Behavior Program, and director of the Institute for Music and Brain Science. He also plays rock and roll guitar, writes songs, and has been active in musical theater. We began our interview with those interesting combinations. You're a medical doctor, also hold a philosophy doctorate, and you studied musical theater, so I'm wondering if you were aiming to become a neurosurgeon, a philosopher, or a song and dance man like Dr. Doolittle.
A song and dance man, actually. You know, the irony is that I failed my audition at 19 years old for David Geffen when he started his Asylum Records.
Wow.
I'd made a demo when I was in high school and auditioned that when that new label came up, and I never heard back from David. So now I'm part of his team. I did become a neurologist after going through undergraduate school. One of the reasons I went to Yale was because it's either the only or one of the few Ivy League schools that actually has a music school and a drama school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there as a pre-med and with an eye towards drama and music, had a rock band there, wrote a lot, spent too much time playing rock and roll with the band, writing a lot of music, ultimately doing demos. But I think as many of us know in the entertainment business, going from song to song, record to record seemed a little bit dicey to me. And I got a great opportunity to train in neurology at New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center and took that opportunity to really ask questions about how the brain processes music and the way that we were all taught about the brain and language.
Well, you obviously were successful in neurology. You have a long list of medical and research credits, and I'll just sum them up by citing from your own biography that your work in patient care has been recognized by best doctors in America and America's top physicians. But what interests me is the very next line of that same biography, which says you're a published songwriter and member of the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. You just mentioned a little bit about your musical background. Can you expand?
Well, I started playing guitar at 6. The Beatles arrived when I was 7 and did the Ed Sullivan Show in my hometown. And like so many young people at that time, certainly teenagers around my block, were forming bands. Dion and the Belmonts are from my neighborhood in the East Bronx. The Young Rascals from that East Bronx neighborhood. So I guess a peak experience was I got scouted at a school Christmas show and played the World's Fair when I was 8.
Wow.
So I was sold. And then obviously the Beatles were just such a major inspiration for all of us in that generation. And that's always been a really big part of my life and really is behind the passion that I have for everything related to music. And it just happens to be in the world of having a job and a career that I was lucky enough to be able to help develop a field with a few other neuroscientists and realize that music as an essential part part of the human condition, is as important as any other part of human cognition to study and understand.
What is this magical thing about music and the brain? Why someone, as you mentioned, could have some sort of brain damage, may be able to sing, but can no longer speak? How is that possible?
Well, I've had that experience with some of my patients who early after a left hemisphere lesion are mute. And they really can activate their articulatory apparatus, the vocal cords, the mouth, the tongue, and so forth, by trying to come up with words because they really can't access words. It's mm-hmm. part of the lesion effect. But for vocalizations for things like vowels, for example, or expletives, interjections, really both hemispheres can generate those kinds of sounds. So the trick is basically to get someone to just get the vocal apparatus going, overcome the inertia, and rather than try to find a word within the mental lexicon that really they can't access, if you get them to try and access some sort of a melody, for example, like Happy Birthday, they can activate the vocal apparatus through that route and get a few speech sounds out, which actually in the first day or two after a stroke, when a patient thinks they can't really make sounds anymore, is very, very dramatic for them to be able to sing Good Morning or sing Happy Birthday.
I've heard of the Mozart effect. Is it any music? Is Miles Davis or Miley Cyrus or Mozart, is it all the same? Does it matter which kind of music you're using to try and reach these magic places in the brain?
I think listener preference is important. I don't think necessarily the type of music should be prescriptive. Although, again, the empirical evidence to support one approach versus the other approach, really, we don't have an empirical answer to that question. But in working with patients and trying to use music in clinical contexts, my own bias, and I think the bias in others who've worked in the field, has been moving away from prescribing 18th century European instrumental music from the classical era, and really being more sensitive to the cultural differences, the individual identity of a particular patient, and allowing them to have some choice about what they're going to listen to. Because of the initial enthusiasm with the Mozart effect, in large part attributable to Don Campbell's important book, there really has been empirical research after that that really addresses more the fact that it's an overall arousal effect that may improve general cognitive processing. I favored the approach of really letting, for example, in a clinical context, having the patients decide what they want to listen to rather than prescribing and saying, you really should be listening to European classical music. You know, that's going to really work for you.
Yeah.
But, it's someone who's from a totally different culture and I'm imposing my belief system onto them. So I really think there's so much variability. And I think a lot of what we hear in these generalities, for example, one of the ones is about music being a right hemisphere function. It's not a right hemisphere function. Mm-hmm. It involves both sides of the brain. What's universal in music is song. Well, song includes vocals and includes words. To a lot of people, maybe you and I differ. Maybe lyrics are really important to me. Lyrics are not really critical to me. I think they help in liking a song, but it's sort of like a secondary effect for me.
And you're a songwriter.
I think a lot of us who write songs, we kind of write those melodies and harmonies first, kind of fill in with some syllables that are sort of neologisms or clang associations, and then sit back at some other time and think about what we may have an overset phrase that's kind of the hook, but then kind of fill in what we're going to say in the verse. And that's a very fairly common way of writing a song. Not every, Elton John, Bernie Taupin gave him the words first, then he wrote the song. So again, there's another example where that may be true of, Lennon and McCartney, that they come up with the words after the tune, but it's not true of Elton John. So there's so much of that. And that's the richness of it. That's the beauty of it, is in the variability, in the individuality of it.
Can you tell me what is the Institute for Music and Brain Science?
The Institute for Music and Brain Science is a private operating foundation. It's a nonprofit, and it was founded by a number of faculty at Harvard Medical School who agreed that this was an important part of neurobiology and also had a lot of potential for medicine. And Sir George Martin, the Beatles producer, was one of the founding members of the board, along with some friends of mine, Jamie Singleton and Caroline Beanstock.
Now, when I saw that Sir George Martin was involved with this, I mean, you and I are probably contemporaries age-wise, and the Beatles were the reason I became a rock band drummer. The Beatles, hugely influential in so many lives. Do you know him? Have you spoken with him?
Well, I got to meet him. The way that I met him was through another board member, a wonderful friend of mine, Bernie Krause, who just published just a wonderful book called The Great Animal Orchestra. Bernie replaced Pete Seeger in The Weavers, wrote many, many film scores, Apocalypse Now, Love Story with his colleague Paul Beaver, and then went on to get a PhD in bioacoustics. And has a company called Wild Sanctuary and goes out into all sorts of places to record the natural sound environment. I mean, Bernie is unbelievable. Bernie brought the Moog to the Beatles, to the Stones, to the Beach Boys. Mm-hmm. He was kind of one of the people who was in between Moog and the rock groups. Just a brilliant guy. And he was friends with George Martin. And Bernie, when he joined the board, was very interested in what we were doing. And we talked about it. So I was, it was very generous of Bernie to introduce me to Sir George, whom, you know, it was one of those say, I can't, you know, like people don't want me to talk about the Beatles anymore because I talk so much about them. Then I'm at lunch with George Martin. He's like gossiping about the Beatles, you know, and I was speechless. But Sir George is very interested because he himself and in general his ilk, there's a lot of hearing loss in the music community, as well know.
Sure.
And so the idea of sort of oral hygiene, but not in the way the dentists talk about it, it's A-U-R-A-L, oral hygiene. That was really, I think, one of the main motivating factors for why Sir George lent his name to the cause. And so we're indebted to him to really give the name to our cause and help us. And obviously, it was a very big thrill to me. Couldn't talk, you know, really. It was all the guy. I mean, one of the great stories I'll share with you right now was he thought that one of the great moments that they had achieved, really a great synthesis and an achievement, was when they were doing things like Strawberry Fields and I Am the Walrus and so forth, that they really broke in new ground.
Mm-hmm.
But then John came back one day and he said, you know, George, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm just a teddy. Uh-huh. And of course, for the Brits, if the audience, you know, a teddy is a rocker.
Sure.
And so they went from Magical Mystery Tour to the White Album.
Yes.
And, you know, it's one of those things where you want to say 80 things at that point and start asking 80 questions. But I just, you know, was speechless.
Have you ever been to Port Townsend before?
No, this is my first time, actually, as an East Coast boy. I've only been on the West Coast a few years now. So there's just some beautiful people that you have working in the field, like Judith Kate Friedman. And it was her vision, her inspiration, that really brought us together here to bring this to her community.
And the West Coast being down in Los Angeles.
Yes.
What are your reactions, thoughts about our little Victorian seaport?
Well, I just took a little shop tour with my daughter, Cadence. You know, I probably would have gone broke if been able to get her everything that she wanted to. And I just happened to walk into one of the bookstores, the William James bookstore. I just came out with about 50 pounds worth of books, you know, because some of the things I couldn't find at university bookstores, I managed to find in that bookstore.
Books about geology usually focus on rocks, mountain ranges, plate tectonics, the great outdoors, and the whole Earth. David Williams has written a very different kind of geology book. It's called Stories in Stone: Travels Through Urban Geology. When he takes students on field trips, it's not in the wilderness, but more often through downtown Seattle, where they look at big buildings. Specifically, they're looking at the stone in those buildings. Williams came to Port Townsend for a lecture, and KPTZ's Phil Andrus talked to him about how he finds stories in stone in the middle of a big city.
So you lead tours.
Yes.
Around cities. Perhaps you might someday consider Port Townsend. But if you take people out and about in an urban environment looking at stone, can you present at least some of what one of your tours might be like?
If it's in Seattle, it's often noisy because of the traffic. But basically, the main tour that I do in Seattle covers about 2 miles. And we start in downtown Seattle and Pioneer Square. And I start there because the reason Seattle has a lot of stone, and this is a story can be told about many places, is when Seattle burned to the ground in 1889, they rebuilt the city and they passed rules that said you can only build with stone and brick. And so that's when the stone starts to come in. So what I do is work my way around downtown, stopping, looking at buildings. So we look at the Pioneer Building to look at some of the sandstone, the Chuckanut sandstone, same sandstone.
Where is the Pioneer Building?
It's right in Pioneer Square, right where the pergola is down there. We go over to Smith Tower and look at the granite that's used at the base of that building, which comes from Index. We then continue up the road to one of my favorite buildings, the Seattle Exchange Building. It's this beautiful Art Deco building at 2nd and Marion. And the stone on that is from Minnesota, and it's 3.54 billion years old, which is 80% of the age of the Earth, which is probably the oldest stone any of us will ever see in our lives. We then work our way up to the Rainier Club, which has a limestone in it, a white limestone that has a lot of fossils. So we look at some fossils, work our way up to the Rainier Tower, where we look at the travertine.
So you did briefly, and maybe you've been to Port Townsend before, probably have, but you did walk around Port Townsend. I'm hoping you know it well enough to suggest to people what they might look at. I mean, a self-guided tour, and or maybe you'll be guiding a tour in Port Townsend. It would be a short one, I think.
Right.
But a self-guided tour of stone buildings in Port Townsend. What would people look to see?
I walked through just along the main strip along the water there. I'm sorry, I don't know names.
Water Street, actually.
Water Street. Clever name. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of buildings. They're very obvious. I mean, the sandstone buildings in Port Townsend are very obvious because they're stone. One thing you might notice I went by is the Leader building, I think.
It's the newspaper, Port Townsend.
Newspaper.
Leader, yes.
And that building, what's interesting, if you look at the stone on it, is that higher up, the stone is in really good shape, but lower down, there's been a lot of erosion going on. And the erosion occurs particularly in sandstones because water gets in and starts to freeze. And as it starts to freeze, it expands and you get the rock starts to break up. So if you look closely at the building behind the sort of shrubbery there, it looks like it's falling apart. It's probably in pretty good shape, but it's neat to see erosion in the building.
Which is the same thing that happens to stone in nature.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the post office and the courthouse are also all made of stone. And it's what's interesting to me about them or unites them all is they're all built in a fairly relatively tight period, and they often have this type of architecture called Richardsonian Romanesque, named for a Boston architect named Henry Hobson Richardson. And it's a very rustic look. It was done often because the buildings, I think the architects wanted to convey the strength of the building. Getting back to our discussion earlier about the stone used as foundation material. And if you can see the stone and see that it has this rough texture, I think it makes it look more natural. And again, in a way, makes the building look more substantial. Structure.
So any other interesting stories about specific buildings in Seattle before we move on to some other subjects?
Well, one of my favorites is a gas station in eastern Colorado that's made of petrified wood. All the structure is petrified wood. And the guy who made it, this is in the early 1930s when gas stations and cars are just starting to become popular. And he did it as a tourist attraction. And the funny thing is, interesting aspect is he stole all the wood from private ground, all this petrified wood, and had it built. And one of the guys who worked on the building later had a very famous career in food, as he's the guy who invented Pop Rocks candy. So there's a story for you. Building stone, petrified wood to Pop Rocks candy.
So the stone in Port Townsend, the sandstone, mm-hmm. I guess you identified quite a bit of those buildings, which are stone made mm-hmm. in Port Townsend, is made of sandstone. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
It comes from two primary areas. The stuff that's a little more grayish and a little less fine grain, so a little coarser grain, more sandy looking. Most of that's from the quarries over in Bellingham at Chuckanut. The other spot where a lot of stone that came into Port Townsend is from Scow Bay on Indian and Meadowstone Island, is it?
Meristone,
excuse
really?
Me, yeah.
That
yeah.
local?
There was a quarry there, and so it's a little bit younger rock, and it's a much finer grained rock that you can see. And those are the two primary areas that supplied stone.
This week's Compass was written and produced by David Cunningham and Phil Andrus. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon with repeat airings Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. exclusively here on KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend.